Thank you.
If I can have 1 second to just organize.
Take your time.
May it please the court, Melissa Danchek. Pleasure to be here today. Good afternoon. What I'd like to address with the court is an issue brought up by the Attorney General that the Attorney General argues that there's a permissible inference that possession of a forged instrument by the accused is a prima facie case, that he either forged the instrument or procured it to be forged. It's the Fitzgerald case, 227 VA 171. If the court does not have that case, I have copies of it to provide to the court.
We're familiar with it.
Your Honor, I would suggest that that is a misstatement of the law in Fitzgerald. In the Fitzgerald case, the inference was that the defendant intended to defraud, and that inference was there given the falsity of the address, the telephone number, what the defendant wrote on the reverse of the checks, the check was made payable to the defendant, that the defendant himself endorsed them. So I think that blanket statement by the Attorney General is not the actual specific inference that is addressed in Fitzgerald. They also discuss in Fitzgerald the writing on the face of the check that was forged. Of course, that case applies to the writings and forgery of written documents. Credit card fraud and credit card has its own subsection that we are dealing with here. So I would suggest that, one, it doesn't apply, and then, two, that it's misstated. One of the cases that does apply and specifically addresses the credit card fraud forgery statutes is Cheatham v. Commonwealth. I do have copies of that case if Your Honors do not have that, but I'll tell the court that that case specifically addresses that mere possession, and this was of a credit card theft, mere possession of a recently stolen credit card is not a prima facie case of guilt, like possession of reasonably stolen goods. So in that case, it talks about the legislative intent that statutes
are...
What's the
cite for that case? I'm sorry.
It is 208 SE2D 760, and I have the copies.
Okay, I'll actually take that for you if you don't mind. Thank you.
May I approach?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I believe that that is more distinguishing of the case. The rest of my arguments, I believe, were made very clear in the brief that this case does not qualify this gift card as a credit card. It was falsely made or it was uttered, and I will address those questions if they come up. Thank you.
So can I ask you just quickly, no, that's all right, Ms. Yates, you can remain there. Where in Cheatham, can you take us to the point that what you're citing to there? Because you gave us the general cite, but just...
Yes, Your Honor. It indicates, and I'm sorry, I had it highlighted all over.
Yeah, that's just what I wanted to do, was to highlight this.
Yes. When I'm looking...
Code sections have been renumbered, so it's a little confusing. So.
If you take a look, and it looks like it's not said here, it's on the last page of the opinion. There's no page numbers indicated on my copy.
I'm sorry, what? You
There's no page numbers indicated
okay.
on my copy.
All right.
I think probably the language you're looking for, we are unwilling to extend the presumption of guilt from unexplained or falsely explained possession of stolen goods. Is that the analogy you're looking
Thank
for?
Thank you, Your Honor. And just the paragraph right
That's
before.
That's the third to the last paragraph on the next to the last page you've given us?
Yes, and the paragraph just before that also specifies that no language in Virginia statute specifically creates a prima facie case of evidence of credit card theft.
Yeah, I know the Fitzgerald case the Commonwealth cited, but the Commonwealth did not cite to this one. So, Ms. Yates, if you would like to send the court something in response to what Ms. Danchek just raised, we'd be happy to receive that from you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good afternoon. May it please the court. Rachel Yates on behalf of the Commonwealth.
Ms. Yates, let me just jump right in and ask you about something that concerns me. And that's the indictment here.
Yes, sir.
I'm sure you knew this was coming. The indictment does not allege what the defendant was convicted of, namely uttering a fraudulent credit card. Now, assuming we get past all the argument about whether this qualifies as a credit card, which is a whole different issue, but for the purpose of my question, let's assume that it is. Here, the trial court offered the opportunity to amend the indictment. The prosecutor elected not to do so. Generally, you don't get to rise any higher than what you allege, and I know you're relying on the fact that the statute was incorporated by reference, but statutes that have multiple ways to get to a conviction are generally not just in court. Otherwise, all we'd need to do would be to present an indictment with a code section on it to a grand jury, and that would be sufficient, which, of course, it isn't. We have several situations where we've reversed and dismissed based on the failure to properly charge. Why doesn't that situation apply here?
Well, to get to the heart of this issue, I'll give you a slightly longer answer. But to start with, it is true that the statute does not explicitly state the word uttering, and it is not ideally drafted.
Well, the statute expressly says that, but the indictment doesn't.
Yes, excuse me. The indictment does not explicitly state that, and it is not ideally drafted. What is unique about this particular indictment is that following the language, it is clear that this was not an intent to elect or narrow certain portions of subsection A of the statute. It's simply a started to read verbatim from the statute and in lieu of continuing to do
that. Ms. Yates, let me stop you because
yes,
I did this for a very long time.
Yes, sir.
I'm well aware of how indictments get presented to grand juries. And I'm well aware of the fact that prosecutors don't always exercise a lot of care in proofreading their indictments, and that's sometimes on them. And this may be one of those cases. Defendants are entitled to be put on notice as to what criminal conduct they are alleged to have committed. And in cases, let's flip it around, in cases where we have emboss, make, utter, and there's no specificity in the indictment, it's just charged generally like that, you'd be entitled to a bill of particulars. And the Commonwealth would have to elect, well, what's my theory? I'm going to allege you uttered it, or I'm going to allege you embossed it, or I'm going to allege you made it. And then the defendant can then proceed with their defense accordingly. Here, by leaving out, the word utter, in effect, the defendant is now on notice that's something they don't have to defend against because the Commonwealth elected not to allege that form of this criminal offense in the indictment. Why shouldn't the Commonwealth be held accountable for that decision?
In that case, Your Honor, I will back up even further. And start at the beginning of this case, is when at motion to strike, this argument was first made to the trial court. Mr. Brito Arate specifically told the trial court, this isn't an issue of variance. This is just an issue of sufficiency. Now on appeal, we're here because Mr. Brito Arate alleges the trial court erred because it didn't find that there was a variance and it didn't find that there was a fatal variance.
Well, it's also a question of sufficiency if that's not what you're charged with. If you present evidence that has no relation to what you're charged with, then, if you're charged with making and there's no evidence of making, that's a sufficiency argument. If you're charged with embossing and there's no evidence of embossing, that's a sufficiency argument, isn't it?
Well, let me answer this in several parts. First, in this particular case, there actually is evidence that Mr. Brito Arate made these fraudulent cards in question. So that is one way to affirm the judgment.
Where is that evidence? Because I couldn't find it anywhere.
When we read the particular statutes at issue here,
he's certainly in possession of, you know, these fraudulent credit cards. There's no question about that. Whether he actually made them or embossed them, I mean, I guess in this case, embossing is putting the raised letters and name and all on the card and the number, and the making would be the physically generating the card along with the magnetic stripe that goes with it. I assume that's in context what the statute means by make or emboss. Am I wrong?
No, Your Honor. It's a slightly broader than that, but it is defined by the same statute in 182.193. Here, a person falsely makes a credit card when he makes or draws, in whole or in part, a device or instrument which purports to be the credit card of a named issuer. So far, Mr. Brito Arate's conduct falls within that.
You lost me there.
Okay.
He possessed it, but where's the evidence he actually manufactured or made these cards?
And this brings us to the point addressed previously in terms of the Fitzgerald case that I cited on brief. Mr. Brito Arate did not file a reply brief and did not raise this, so I am somewhat of a disadvantage in responding. But I can say from my brief review of this Cheatham case that it does not appear to be directly applicable. The court was being asked to respond to the claim that this prima facie case argument would apply when someone withheld a credit card. And under those facts, it appears...
Well, you're relying on a presumption in a forgery case that that the possessor of a forged instrument is presumptively subject to rebuttal, presumptively the maker of that.
Yes, or permissive inference, yes, sir.
But of course, in that particular case that you're referring to there, that's basically a check forgery situation,
yes.
Requires a pen. In a case of forging a credit card, it requires some pretty sophisticated equipment to put to both make and emboss the card and put a magnetic stripe on it with a particular account number.
Yes.
So why would we assume that the same analogy would apply, something you could do with the stroke of a pen that anybody has access to simply possessing a forged credit card means that you've by definition, presumptively possess all that sophisticated equipment somewhere?
I don't know how much sophisticated equipment would necessarily be required, but an answer to your question...
More than a pen, wouldn't you agree?
Perhaps more than a pen, yes. But what I would say is that who is the person who benefits from that? It's the person who's putting it forward and trying to utter it. So
well, we wouldn't need to put uttering in the statute if you know every time you possessed it you were presumptively the maker. I mean it would.
Well, just like to answer your question, just like in any forge or utter case, that person can be convicted of both. I mean, if conduct under the statute would qualify for both making and uttering, then person could be convicted twice. For those two different sets of conduct.
Yeah, if I forge a check and take it to a bank and present it and receive money in return, that's forgery, uttering, and larceny. But the fact that I present the check at the bank doesn't automatically mean that I'm guilty of forgery. I'm just guilty of uttering and maybe larceny. The presumption, you're charged with forgery or not, I guess it's up to the fact finder to determine. But here the indictment doesn't charge those things like it would be in a forgery situation.
Yes, the indictment is not ideal. What I will then say in response to the court's question of why shouldn't we hold the Commonwealth accountable? Well, in addition to my 518 argument where in the trial court the only argument made was this person was not put on notice of being charged with B or C, not that there was a specific issue with uttering at the trial court level, which is important because at that point, as the court mentioned, the Commonwealth could have had a motion to amend if that was appropriately addressed and it wasn't. And in addition to the approbate and reprobate argument I made on brief in terms of telling the trial court there was no variance issue, in addition to those things, what I would say to the court is even if there is a variance, and it seems that that this might be...
Are you familiar with our decision... actually, it's the Supreme Court's decision, I'm sorry. It's our decision, in Purvey versus Commonwealth back in 2011.
Yes, sir.
We held in that case when the Commonwealth elects to narrow a factual allegation in an indictment, they're basically stuck with that. They're, you know, that frames the context or the you know, what happens thereafter if they elect to, you know, of course, if they expand it to the limits of the statute, then as I said earlier, it can be narrowed at the request of the defense through a bill of particulars.
Yes, sir.
So
I'd be happy to distinguish perfect.
Go ahead. Knock yourself out.
I will do my best. In the Purvey case, it is similar in that it does address the same subsection. There, it was a failure to register versus a providing materially false statement. And the Commonwealth in the indictment had failed to register, and all of the proof at trial was made materially false statements. And when raised to the trial court, the parties simply found, well, it generally references the code section, and that's good enough. Here what we have is something different, because instead of specifically electing or narrowing, this is a case where the Commonwealth just quit writing part of the statute and referenced the code section. But separate from that, even if the court feels that Purvey is otherwise somewhat analogous, what I would say, and I don't know that this argument was made to the Purvey court, what I would say is that even if there is a variance, for something to be a fatal variance, there are very specific things that need to be found. And in this case, Mr. Brito Herrate has not met those requirements. The Supreme Court of Virginia in the Hawks case cited on brief has held, a variance is only fatal if the proof is different from and irrelevant to the crime charged, and is therefore insufficient to prove the commission of the crime charge. In this particular case, it's the Commonwealth's position that the proof at issue in terms of making versus uttering.
Ms. Yates, are you familiar with our decision in Sutphin versus Commonwealth?
I'm sorry, you said Sutphin?
Sutphin.
No, sir.
That was a case where perjury was charged. Of course, there's two different flavors of perjury, two different statutes that govern perjury in Virginia. One is common law perjury, and the other is a statutory form of perjury. In Sutphin, the Commonwealth charged one form but proved the other. And we reversed and dismissed, pointing out that he was never charged with what he was convicted of. Well, actually, I take that back, because we actually affirmed because they never argued the ends of justice, which they probably should have. But it was pretty clear that, I think we made it pretty clear in that case, that it was error for the court to permit that to go forward the way it did, given the variance between the proof and what the indictment actually specified the criminal conduct was that was alleged.
Your Honor, if this court in the Sutphin case said only that the proof is different, well, that certainly sounds like a variance, and without having seen it, I trust the court's recitation is correct. But what I would say is the Supreme Court of Virginia has said very specifically when something is a fatal variance, and this doesn't meet the definition of fatal variance. Further, there's no prejudice to the accused in this case, which is another requirement to overcome if something
You don't think the conviction is prejudice? If he was convicted of conduct he wasn't charged with, that's not prejudicial?
That would be something different. Otherwise, there would be no requirement of prejudice. All you'd have to show is that you were convicted. So clearly they mean something more. And in this particular case...
Well, let me ask you a different question. Suppose we don't agree with you.
Yes, sir.
And if this were to be reversed, clearly it seems to me, would you have... if he's not convicted of the crime he's charged with, then double jeopardy principles wouldn't apply, and there'd be nothing barring retrial here on an uttering charge, would there?
There would be nothing barring retrial in this case because the evidence is sufficient to prove uttering. So, yes, it would be correct that he could be retried.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Does the court have any further questions? I'm happy to answer any other issues.
I don't have any additional questions.
Thank you, Your Honor.
No additional questions. You have another couple minutes.
I hate to steal all of Judge Atlee's thunder. I know he loves to ask questions.
All right, thank you, Ms. Yates.
Thank you.
All right, you have your 12 minutes if you
thank
want
you.
To use it for rebuttal or whatever, if you further argument.
If Your Honors, I'd like to open questions to Your Honors if you would like to start there. I don't want to repeat myself in my briefs. So.
Well, let me ask you one question about the credit card definition.
Yes.
I know you take the position that this does not meet the definition of a credit card, and let me see if I can find my note here quickly. The statute defines a credit card, and I'm still trying to find it, but I'm still going to go from memory. You can correct me if my memory is failing like the rest of me is here. But one of the definitions in the statute for a credit card includes a debit card where it's drawn on the account of a bank or of another.
That's right.
Why doesn't this meet that definition?
Your Honor, so I would love to address that. So when you look at the statute, 191 is what defines what a credit card is.
Right.
And I broke it down into specific, actually breaking it down in more of a elementary sort of issue. If you were applying, if we were articulating that this was a debit card, that would fall under...
Why isn't it a debit card? It's a, assuming it was valid, it's a gift card drawn on, I don't know, some company or other that's offered me a Walmart that's given me a gift card for $10, and I want to redeem that, that's $10 going to be charged against Walmart, isn't it?
Your Honor, I think that the issue... I think that a debit card... I guess Your Honors could interpret it to be the same.
I mean, the money has to come from somewhere.
Right, and it could come from cash. And that's one of the things. When you look at the definition, if the Attorney General is going on the procedure that a credit card is under the, for purposes of this article, credit cards shall also include. That's the second part of the definition on 191. It talks about a similar device known as a debit card or any other name, issued with or without a fee by an issuer for the use of a cardholder, which I explained in my brief, cardholder is also specifically defined in 191, in obtaining goods, money, services, that applies, by charging the account of the cardholder with a bank or any other person.
If I go to, I don't know, let's say Target, I'll go upscale from Walmart, I go to Target, and I want to give a gift to Judge Beals, my good friend Judge Beals. Or you. I probably have to recuse myself if I do that. But
please ask him what the value of said gift is.
Good call.
I'm going to give Judge Beals $25 for Christmas, and I'm going to put it in the form of a Visa gift card. Okay?
Yes.
And I go to Target, and I give him $25 in cash, and they issue me a now valid gift card with $25 in cash on that. He can use that either, you know, for any purchase up to $25 or towards $25 towards any greater amount, correct?
Yes.
Now, when he does that, when he presents that card and they deduct whatever amount, that deduction comes from an account at the place where I purchased it, does it not? Because they're the ones that loaded it up with the cash. In this case, it's going to be Target.
Well, I think that account would be closed because it was the $25 in exchange.
Somebody didn't stuff $25 United States currency inside that credit card. It's in an account somewhere. And by definition, if Target's giving me the card, that's where I purchased it, they put my money in the cash register. That now goes into an account owned by Target, and Visa is going to charge that account when I present that, or Judge Beals presents that card somewhere, isn't he?
Yes, but I think Your Honor is missing the point of that it talks about, when it talks about any debit card or any other name, it has to be charging the account of the cardholder. In this case, a cardholder means the person or organization named on the face of a credit card, which I allege this is not a credit card, but the cardholder, this is what it's defined as, to whom, for whose benefit the card is issued by an issuer. That is compared to the Hill case that was cited, and I still have copies of it. But the issue is cardholder, it indicates specifically by this definition, named on the face of a credit card. So you didn't name Judge Beals.
Well, his name is not on the card. There's no name on the card. It's a gift card.
Exactly. So therefore, you don't have a cardholder.
So if I understand your logic correctly, no fraudulent card, you could never get a conviction with a fraudulent debit or credit card for that matter, because the person doesn't meet the definition of a cardholder if there's no such account.
You could not get it on a gift card where no person is named. You can get it on a debit card. You can get it.
But if that person doesn't have an account, they still don't meet the definition of a cardholder, do they?
Repeat that question.
If I understand your logic, you have to meet the definition of cardholder in order to be subject to the statute.
Correct.
And to meet the definition of cardholder, you have to have an account.
No, you have to have a name on the face of the credit card, which is 191 if you look at the definition
of cardholder. Any credit card that does not have a name on there, it would not allow you to be, you couldn't use that to get a conviction.
Well, it wouldn't be a credit card. That's the issue. A credit card is specifically defined as something, first of all, if we go under the first definition, of obtaining money, goods, or service of anything else of value on credit. So the issue is that, is in the Hill case, there was a $5,000 line of credit given. This card wasn't prepaid. It actually had to be based on a credit application or history. So it's very specific, anything else of value on credit. A gift card is not given on credit.
Nothing needs to be repaid. It simply dwindles down whatever amount is on the card.
No, but it is, in the abstract, it's still a debit card because it's debiting an account somewhere.
Or the account itself metaphorically is on the card, and the account is simply fixed by the amount that's placed on the card to begin with. It's a kind of a fixed figure account. $100 gift card, you have $100 that you can spend on that card, however far it may get you.
Well, I don't even know that there's an account involved because it replaces the actual $100 bill. The only reason why people give gift cards instead of a $100 bill is because they don't.
There has to be an account. I mean, I'm not a CPA. I took, accounting in college, and I think I can manage to do my taxes without going to federal prison every year. So it doesn't make me an expert, but my understanding is that there's only two. I mean, all accounting is a ledger situation. All accounts are ledger entries, whether it's your bank account, whatever. I mean, and so unless you're doing cold hard United States currency exchange for goods, you're dealing with an account somewhere. That account, as Judge Atlee points out, may be with Visa, it may be with the bank, it may be, but when you redeem it, at some point, there's that transaction is traced back and the money is taken from an account somewhere. Maybe we don't know whose account as we sit here arguing about this today, but it's coming from somewhere. Otherwise, the books are never going to balance.
And I submit to Your Honor, I will not disagree any further with you in an effort to save
but
time.
But that's different from whether the cardholder's name needs to be on. That's a different argument, it seems to me.
Well, it's different. Each one's an essential element. That's the problem.
Yeah,
so the Commonwealth has to prove each and every essential element beyond a reasonable doubt. And when you look at what a definition of a credit card means, it is defines, it actually specifies a cardholder. So then you have to go to the cardholder definition as well. But the credit card, once again, it has to be based on something value on credit. That is not the case in regards to a gift card. We don't know how this was purchased.
Can we change your...
Absolutely.
You're running out of time here.
Yes.
Talk to me a little more about why, given the fact scenario here that was described to us in both briefs in the background, how this happened and how I ended up being charged. Why is the fact the word uttering is left out of the indictment, given what he did here, where is he not on notice that he presented that credit card to, or card, whatever it is, to get goods and used it in order to get something that he wanted?
Well, I think Judge Humphreys made the argument best for me, and that was that he was...
Maybe you'll be a gift card then.
It does limit. So it's the Commonwealth's way of issuing a bill of particulars that they have specified what it is. And, of course, I'm not going to go to them as the defense attorney and say, hey, you missed something. But just the argument that we just stopped writing the code section, I don't think is a plausible argument to find my client guilty. But I don't think he was on notice. He was actually on notice that he wasn't being charged with uttering. He was being charged with making or embossing. So I think uttering, one, he's not guilty of, one, I would suggest he's not guilty of uttering a falsely made or embossed credit card, knowing it was false, nor did he falsely make or emboss a credit card. Once again, this is not a credit card under any definition of the statute. I think it is wholly.
So that's how you answer it wasn't making a credit card, because you say it's just not a credit card.
Well, no, I'm saying even if Your Honors believe that he made this credit card, mm-hmm. we would have to, once again, it says making a credit card is in subsection 2 of 19 or 18.2.193, that he makes a credit card if he is the named issuer, but which is not a credit card because the issuer did not authorize the making or drawing, or he alters which was validly issued. We have no evidence whatsoever that he altered such a card in any way. Once again, you would not have altered it, Judge Beal, if Judge Humphreys had given it to you. And honestly, the target person could have been the one that actually altered it because they took that money. And so they're selling these cards that, once again, you don't know. So even if it was a credit card, which I suggest it's not, there was no presumption of Your Honor knowing that it is a forged instrument, I'll say, in that manner. And it was clearly not.
Given the wording of the indictment.
Given the wording of the indictment and given the reading of the statute, as I said, even if Your Honors found that it was a credit card, I think he did not utter knowing, which is required, the intent of knowing that it was falsely made or embossed. That's why I started my argument with the fact that inference is not as it was seen by the brief. Any other questions?
Any further questions for counsel? All right. We will greet counsel, and then this court will be in recess until 9 tomorrow morning.